Turn with me to 1 Corinthians. First Corinthians chapter 8. If you was going to write a letter to a church that had a lot of problems, what would you say? If you was going to write a letter to somebody that was having a lot of problems, because it's church in... That's okay, we'll just start all over. If you was going to write a letter to a church that had a lot of problems, or to people within the church that was having a lot of problems, First Corinthians is such a book, and the people within the church were having a lot of problems, and Paul said a lot of things to these people in this book. But in the 8th chapter of 1 Corinthians, one of the things that he felt impelled to write to them, in verse number 3, but if any man just love God. That's pretty good. Whatever problem you have, just love God. God will somehow get us through our difficulties. Back in the early 1900s, and I'm sure you've seen the pictures of the ships that were steaming in from Europe that were bringing... The history book says they weren't coming into America by the hundreds nor by the thousands. But in the early 1900s, tens of thousands of European immigrants were pouring into this country. They had been inspired by the words of Emma Lazarus, who had written them in Europe, and those words are stenciled on the first steps of the Statue of Liberty even today. And those words read, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free. And those words caught fire throughout the continent of Europe, and all the difficulties they were facing. People was looking for new life and freedom, and so they began to pour into this country again by the tens of thousands. And you've seen those ships coming in New York Harbor. They're coming to Ellis Island, and all the people that were coming into America. The major institution that was established to teach these immigrants was the United States or the New York public school system. But you see, when these immigrants were coming, they were bringing their culture with them, their own culture. They were bringing their own history with them. And they were bringing their own language. But America did not want to lose her culture. And America did not want to lose her history. And America did not want to lose her English language. So they established in the school system to begin to teach these immigrants and these immigrant children history and language and culture. And what they did, what they established, they wrote a book. The government sponsored a book. And you can find a few copies of them in the old bookstores. They're a beautiful blue book with with engraved American flags upon them. And the book was called The Manual of Patriotism. And what our government wanted to teach those children was patriotism. Patriotism, they said back in those early 1900s, was alive in this country. Said it was a flame. Said you could feel the spirit of patriotism all over this land. Dewey had defeated the Spanish in Cuba, and Teddy Roosevelt and his Rough Riders was every child's playground, role model, and example, and every child wanted to get out and be Teddy Roosevelt. The spirit of patriotism across this land was felt from the White House to the schoolhouse to the church house and to every house. And that book that those teachers held in their hands and stood before them students, the purpose of that book was to instill the spirit of patriotism again into these children. It was to promote a love for this country. It was to promote a love for the founding fathers. You go look in the history section of Barnes and Noble's in the bookstores today, and you'll find as many books on the faults of our founding fathers as you will on the courage of our founding fathers. But they were taught to love our founding fathers and taught to love this country. They were taught to love the Declaration of Independence. They were taught to love the Constitution of the United States. And they were taught to love the brave men who had died for the freedom that you and I still enjoy today. One of the greatest honors that I've ever enjoyed that I'll take with me all the way to my grave. My wife and I was getting ready on a Saturday morning to drive to Louisiana for a meeting, and I opened up our city newspaper, and there at the big gun show that they were having in the convention hall, there was a guest speaker that was going to be speaking and be presenting his selling his books at this gun show. At that time, I was reading Bob Green's book called Duty, and it was a book about his dad who had been in World War II and was returning from the war, and now he was slowly dying of cancer. And Bob Green was a syndicated author. Writer for the Chicago Tribune, and he was flying from Chicago to Columbus back and forth to visit with his father on his deathbed. And he would sit there beside his dad, and his dad would look up at him, and he would say, "I saw Paul Tibbetts the other day. I saw Paul Tibbetts." Paul Tibbetts was the pilot of the Enola Gay that dropped the bomb on Hiroshima that ended World War II. He was an old patriot, an old brave man that they fought him all the way to his grave. Some people call him a mass murderer. They wanted to file treason upon him, and they protested him in his when he made personal appearances here and there. But Harry Truman called old Paul Tibbetts into his office one day, and he said, "Look," he said, "I don't want to lose 1,000 boys on the land invasion to Japan. I'd rather drop one bomb and end this war and save the lives of all them boys." And those boys that he saved became the fathers that you and I had that came back from World War II. Paul Tibbetts was the guest speaker, and they brought him in a wheelchair and rolled him up to that table. And I love to hear my wife tell the story better than I do, but boy, people had gathered up to see him and greet him and get his autograph, and she said, "I cut in front of everybody," and everybody looked at me and didn't dare say nothing to me. But I stood there, and I got his autograph on a couple of books, and I bought a book that he had written on the Enola Gay, and I got him to sign that book. And then I bent down, and I shook his hand, and him being hard of hearing, I leaned up into his face, and I said, "Mr. Tibbetts, I just want to thank you for me and my dad." But you see, there was a time when they were taught to love them men that gave their lives for this country. Amen. You see, patriotism is a love for one's country that is so strong and so passionate that you're willing to die for it. It's a passion that aims to serve. Patriotism is a burning passion that defends from an invasion. Patriotism is a burning passion that protects the rights of ourselves, our children, and others. Patriotism is a passion that maintains the laws. So what is that that brings a tear to our eye when we hear the national anthem? And what is that that pride, what is that that swells up in our heart when we hear the Pledge of Allegiance? And what is that, those emotions that overflow when we see a flag waving in the breeze? And what is that that pains our soul at the report of one of our soldiers dying on foreign soil? And what is that that overwhelms us when we hear taps being played over a flag-draped coffin? And what is that that angers us when foreign enemies wreak havoc upon our shores? And what is that in a little boy that wants to play with guns and tanks and hold a rifle? Can I tell you that's patriotism? That's the spirit of patriotism that used to blow across this land. Those children were taught from those teachers. They used the old McGuffey readers. If you can find them in the old bookstores, they're always tattered and the pages are torn. But they were so full of those patriotic themes. And it was instilled in those boys. And keep in mind, those immigrant children that came into Ellis Island that they taught patriotism, those were the boys that grew up and went to war to fight for the freedom that we have. That was our fathers and grandfathers. They were taught those patriotic themes from them McGuffey readers, but they were taught to respect the flag. We're taught to respect it. I grew up in that orphan's home. And we had, on the front lawn of that orphan's home, we had a 30-foot flagpole. And it was always an honor to be picked in the mornings to take that flag out and hook those eyelets onto those hooks and raise that flag. And it was always an honor in the evening to go out at sundown, and we would bring that flag down and fold it and make sure that it was folded right with the three stars looking up. And the old man that raised us taught us, he said, "Boys, if that flag ever hits the ground, we're going to have to burn it." And I can remember how careful we were when we would hold that flag and do everything in the world to keep it from touching the ground. And I was out there from 1956 to 1967, and not one time did we burn one flag because it ever hit the ground. I can remember when the flag would be blowing in the breeze and somebody would say, "It's raining," and us boys would fly out of that dormitory and we'd go get the flag out of the rain. We didn't even want that flag in the rain. They were taught patriotism and respecting the old flag. They opened each day with the Pledge of Allegiance. Those immigrant children were taught the songs of patriotism. They read 10 verses in the Old Testament, 10 verses in the New Testament. And then they quoted the Lord's Prayer. They learned the quotes of those patriotic men. They learned the quote of Patrick Henry when he said, "I don't know what course others may take, but as for me, you either give me liberty or give me death." They learned the quote of Nathan Hale, who stood upon that buckboard when Cornwallis caught him sneaking into those enemy lines as a school teacher to get the strategies and the war plans of Cornwallis. And he looked up at him when he was caught standing on the back of that wagon. He said, "You got anything to say before I hang you?" And Nathan Hale said, "I just regret that I have not got but one life to give for my country." There at Valley Forge, George Washington looked at those boys that were ragged and tattered and half-starved, and clothes were coming off of them from the harsh winter. And he looked at them before they went to fight that big war, and he said, "The fate of unborn millions depends upon your courage." You know who the fate of those unborn millions were? That's us. That's exactly who he was talking about. In those days, Lincoln's birthday on February the 12th was celebrated. Those days, Washington's birthday on February the 22nd was celebrated. Flag Day on June the 14th was celebrated. And of course, Independence Day on the 4th of July was celebrated. Those students were taken when they had their field trips. They weren't taken to theme parks and water parks. They took them to historic places so that they could see what men had gone through and the sacrifice they had paid for the freedom that they was enjoying. They took them to Bunker Hill and showed them where the ground bled red from the lives of young men who had fought to keep the British from coming and taking away our rights. They were taken to Valley Forge. They were taken to Gettysburg. Students back in those days were taught them old patriotic songs. They learned the song America. And when they sung that song, they learned those words that God is the author of liberty. And if you have any freedom tonight, can I tell you it was God that authored that liberty? Wherever liberty is in this world, I'm telling you it's God that gave it. They learned the song, the Battle Hymn of Republic. And in that song, it was stamped upon their heart that God is marching on. They learned the old song, My Country's 'Tis of Thee. And in that song, they learned those words, Great God and King. They learned the Star-Spangled Banner. And in that song, they learned the words, In God We Trust. Well, you see, in those days, patriotism and morality and God all existed together. It was in the schools. It was in the government. It was in our society. Lincoln said that America, it's bigger than any sect, interest, or faction. He said she consists of mystic cords of memory stretching from every battlefield, from every patriot grave to every living American heart. Albert Einstein said this. He said the world is a dangerous place to live. He said, but it's not because of the people who are evil, but it's because of the people who won't do anything about it. Lincoln went on to say, America will never be destroyed from the outside, that if we falter and lose our freedom, it will be because we destroyed ourselves. But then became the attacks. Then came the attacks upon patriotism. And it began in the early 1950s. There became a movement that began to attack patriotism and religion. They began to say that religion in the early 50s, they said religion should not be taught in schools. They began to make light and mock patriotism. In 1950, the Lord's Prayer was taken out of schools. In 1950, on June the 14th, 1954, they added under God to the Pledge of Allegiance of the United States because they saw all the attacks that was coming upon this country. 1963, I can still remember as a sophomore in high school sitting there in that desk when that loudspeaker come on, and it said, this is James W. Simpson. I am your principal, and the Supreme Court has ruled that we can no longer start our day with prayer and scripture. The radicals had begun to attack every American virtue that had made this country strong. Patriotism was called a refuge for scoundrels. The military was called the imperialistic greed. And religion, they said, was for fools. So a virus had stricken our society. And now it's over 100 years later. It's 100 years later since patriotism was so strong in this country. And teachers today can no longer promote patriotism or religion in the schools. So is there an institution left to promote patriotism? Where would you ever go to get moved by a spirit of bravery and patriotism? And somebody would say, it's the church. Well, I'll agree with you. But if it's a church, then we're also still in trouble. Can I say tonight, there are spiritual immigrants that are pouring into the church. And they are bringing with them a new language, unlike anything we've ever heard in the 200 years of our existence. I don't make fun and light. I know that God is an awesome God. But can I tell you, an awesome God doesn't replace an almighty God? Here are these spiritual immigrants. They're bringing a whole new culture with them, a whole new system of beliefs that are foreign to anything that's ever been preached. They're bringing their new Bibles. They're bringing their new songs. They're bringing a whole new way of worship. They're bringing a whole new history with them. They're bringing new doctrines, and they're bringing all those old, they're bringing all these new things into the church. And what it has done, it has destroyed that old spirit of patriotism that used to be in the church. That old love for God, that you loved God so much that you was willing to give your life and die for Him if need be. That old love for the church that used to be so strong that people gave their life for the church. And if you don't believe that, you can go back and dig in those religious sections and them old bookstores, and there are books written about people that lived and died so that the church could have all the life and the spirit and the power of God. I went downtown Houston in 1984 and took an old beer joint, and we went inside and we put a pearl tile floor and built a platform and put up a pulpit, and we polyurethane all the cedar wood, and we had a beautiful little church in the prostitute and drug district of downtown Houston, Texas. And we had, and for the next 15 years, we would bring in them old boys and girls and runaways and fugitives and drunks and mental patients and drug addicts and prostitutes. We would bring them in that little chapel, and we would preach, and the Spirit of God would move. We had an old gal downtown. The meanest person in all of downtown Houston was a woman by the name of Wino Winette. She had the reputation of whooping any man downtown. And I remember when Wino Winette ripped the doors off my church. And we had a man come down and we welded the hinges to the door jams to keep old Wynette from ripping the doors off. But I'll never forget, in the middle of the night one time, they ripped them doors off. And he died just a couple of years ago after me and my wife married. And we would go out to the little old clinic where he got a brain tumor. And boy, he was laying there in that bed, and I'd walk in and he could barely talk, and he'd look up at me and say, "Oh, it's good to see you, preacher." And for years, I had preached old Scotty and fed him and been his friend and helped him. But I remember the night they ripped the doors off my church. And old Scotty curled up and laid down in the doorway of my church to make sure that nobody in the middle of the night would come in and steal all the things that we had. You say, what was that? I call it patriotism. He just loved his church so much, and he laid in the doorway and he said, "You're not coming in. You're not coming in to take anything that's not yours." But you see, that old love for the church and that old love for God used to exist in this land. I mean, a love for the Bible that was so strong that you was willing to fight and die for the truth of it. A spiritual patriotism is a burning passion that just wants to serve. Well, there used to be a time in the church when people would come to church and they'd say, "Pastor, you got anything for me to do?" You didn't have to ask them. You didn't have to pull them. I'm telling you, that spirit was alive in their heart, and they wanted to serve wherever they could. Spiritual patriotism is a burning passion that wants to serve God. It's a patriotism that wants to defend. If you do not defend the principles you believe, somebody will take them away from you. If you do not defend the preacher's right to preach, they will come in your church and they will take it away from you. If you do not believe in that pulpit's power, it will lose that power. If you don't believe in them old prayer meetings, you will lose them old prayer meetings. In the middle of World War II, they were going to have an award ceremony, and they brought in the generals from all over the European theater, and they had a big convention hall in downtown Washington, D.C., and that limousine pulled up that evening, and it stopped, and out stepped General Patton. And there hanging on his arm was Miss Patton. They started up those steps, and you come across that little lobby, and you walk into those double doors, and there was that convention hall with all them big round tables with American flags draped upon it. And you know how, you've seen the pictures, and I'm sure you've read some of the stories of old Patton. When you looked at Patton, you didn't have to guess what he was. He walked like a soldier. He talked like a soldier. He looked like a soldier. He smelled like a soldier. He dressed like a soldier. And here he was with that chest puffed out. And I'm telling you, he had his decorations on and he had his wife under his arm. And he's starting to cross that lobby to go through them double doors. And there sat right beside the double doors in the lobby, there sat a man that had been drinking all afternoon. And he looked up from that chair and he said, "General Patton, I guess you think you are somebody. I bet those medals on your chest are not even yours. I bet you stole them or borrowed them." He said, "I bet all the stories they're telling about you aren't even true." He said, "I bet all the newsreels that people are seeing, they're just full of lies." About that time, Miss Patton jumped on this guy. She jumped on him, and she had a little old fist about that wide. And she began to pound this old boy in the nose, and they said blood squirted out of both nostrils. She was down, she was straddled on top of him, pounded him in the nose, saying, "You're not going to talk about my husband like that. You're not going to say those things." And she was just beating the tar out of this guy. It took the military police to pull her off of him. He better thank God that Patton didn't get a hold of him. He couldn't even whoop her. But what I'm saying is that wife, that bride, was not going to let you talk about her husband. And can I tell you, the church, you ought not let this old world talk about your Lord and mock your God without standing up and saying something. That's that old spirit of patriotism that used to be in the church that we are slowly losing if it's not already gone. Patriotism wants to serve. Patriotism will defend. Patriotism will protect. I've been to Westminster Abbey over in London twice now. And all the old colorful characters of generals and orators and people of history that are famous are all buried in Westminster Abbey. All the greats, their statues and their tombs, the kings and the queens and all the statesmen, they're just all buried in Westminster. And to go through it is just like taking a trip back in time. And we're making our way down through the little old pathway, and there's tombs on the right and tombs on the left of people that were buried back in 1500s and 1400s and 1200s. And when you get down to the end on that right side, and just as you make the turn, there's where old King James is buried. And twice in my life, I have stopped and bowed my knee right there, and I just said, "Old King James." I didn't bow my knee to worship him. I just bowed my knee to thank him. I wanted to thank him for authorizing this old book that was being preached the day I got saved. This old book that has been my light and darkness and anchor in my storms. This old book that has gave me strength and gave me everything that I have today. I just want to say, "Oh, King James, I just want to thank you again." I guess I stayed there too long on this particular when I was with my wife, because when I stood back up, people had to stop behind me that was making their way. And when I turned around, my heart was so full. And there stood this man and woman with two teenagers, and my heart was overflowing. I just began to tell them all about King James. I begin to tell him when he was, when he lived, and I begin to tell him about the book that he authored, and I'm just going on and on. They're just sitting there looking at me like, And I walked off so proud of myself, and my wife tugged on my arm and said, "They don't understand English." And I walked away, and I said, "Well, I got to tell them anyway. Thank God they didn't enjoy it. I enjoyed it." But patriotism wants to serve. And patriotism wants to defend. And patriotism wants to protect. You've got to maintain your beliefs and your convictions or you'll lose them. But patriotism, it's a spirit that loves the church. For you see, written in this old Bible are the words that we have preached from this pulpit for the last 200 years of our history. In this book, it said, "Bring in hither the halt, the blind, the lame, and the poor, that my house may be filled." Can I tell you, this city and this state and this country is filled with people that want to be free from the vices and sins and addictions, but they don't know where to turn or who to turn to. But I'm telling you, there's a pulpit with a Bible and a church, and just bring them in. You've never lived till you see a house full of sinners get in that old church and the power of God fall and watch them old gals and guys get saved. I'm telling you, it's one of the most greatest sights and scenes you've ever seen in all your life. But they're yearning for freedom. Patriotism for the church is a patriotism for preaching. Old John Bunyan wrote that book, Pilgrim Progress. And there's another reason why you better be glad that I'm not God. Because if I was God, I wouldn't even let you in heaven if you hadn't read Pilgrim Progress at least one time. If you showed up for heaven, if you showed up at them gates, and I was standing there and said, have you read Pilgrim's Progress? No. Well, you get back down there and you live until you read it, and then you show it back up here. I'm telling you, John Bunyan gave 13 years of his life in a Bedford jail to write that book. And they said at one time it was in every home in America. They said the old Bible and Pilgrim's Progress was in every home. But old John Bunyan was a street preacher. He was an old watch tinker, and he got saved. And boy, when he got saved, he got lit on fire. And he preached in the barnyard, street corners, hay fields. He preached everywhere. And finally, they got so tired of hearing him, they pulled him in the court, and they said, look, if you're going to do any more preaching, you're going to have to take a license. But Bunyan knew that if he took those licenses, that they would tell him where he could preach and what he could preach and when he could preach. But that day that they brought him before Judge Keeling, and you can read it in his life, in his autobiography, he said he turned around and there stood his wife and his 12-year-old blind daughter, Mary. And he knew that if he took that license, he could go home with his wife and blind daughter. But if he did not take that license, she was going to lose her husband, and that little girl was going to lose her daddy. And in his book, he said, it felt like my heart was being ripped in half. But he turned, and the Spirit of God, he says, quoted, he said, the Spirit of God spoke to my heart, Jeremiah 49:11. And that verse says, leave thy fatherless children. I will preserve them. And let thy widows trust in me. And old John Bunyan turned his back to his family and looked up at that judge, and he said, I won't stop preaching till the moss grows over my eyeballs. And they put him in that Bedford jail for 13 years while he wrote that famous book. But that's that old spirit of patriotism for preaching that you just don't find anymore. There was an old mountain preacher up in the mountains of Goodlettsville, right outside of Goodlettsville, Tennessee, in Millersville. And old Bobby Shelton, me and him hooked up in the mid-80s, and boy, I went up there into the 90s, and I preached so many meetings for him. And I'm telling you, there is nothing like preaching to a bunch of old backwoods mountain folk that hadn't got no pride. They will shout their hair down. They will worship until the moon comes. And I can always remember when old Bobby's legs was taller than the pulpit. And that old long, tall, lanky mountain boy would get in that pulpit and just lean over the top of that thing, and that crowd would be filling up in that church. And he would say, church! He said, prayer time. And all the women would go behind into a Sunday school room behind the piano, and all the men would get up and go off into the little fellowship hall. And the men would go back there, and they would all bow down upon one knee. They'd take about 5 minutes and tell God everything that he needed to do for the next 3 hours. And the men would come out, and they would sit down. But them women wasn't in no hurry. They'd be back yonder 10, 15, 20, one time 30 minutes. And we sat there, and when that door opened, and them gals come out with their faces, with them tears coming down their cheeks, and when they come out, I'm telling you, a spirit of God come out of that prayer room with them weeping mountain women, and it come across that church, and I'm telling you, we shouted for the next hour, didn't need no singing, no preaching at all. But old Bobby Shelton, he finally had back pains, wouldn't go to a doctor. His wife Mary finally got him to go to a doctor, found out that he had cancer that was eating his spine in two. Finally, they put him in that back bedroom, and couldn't do nothing else for him. And Mary had that little bottle of morphine, and she'd have to drop it, put that morphine in his mouth about every hour to kill the pain. Week before he died, I went by his house right outside of Nashville. I walked back there in that back bedroom, and Bobby was laying on that bed, and he was just wilting away because they'd taken everything, the liquids of food and everything off of him. And I walked over to the bed, and I leaned down, and I looked at him, and old Bobby opened up them eyes, and he seen me. And that old feeble hand worked its way up, and he pointed at me right in my face, and he said, "Keep on preaching. Keep on preaching." And I'm telling you, there's been times since 1995 that I didn't know if I could keep on preaching. There had been times I thought that I might want to quit from all the troubles that I was having. But every time that I even thought about it, I heard that old mountain man say, "Keep on preaching. Keep on preaching." And every time I hear it, them old pistons get to popping, and that old fire will get to burning, and I'll be looking for some place to preach. There's times I want to preach so bad and so much, I'm sitting there and I'm saying, "Why are we even singing? Stop. Just let me preach. Who cares? My motor's running. Let me go." I was going to New York City, and I met old Jim Barnhagen back in the early 90s, and the old Macaulay Water Street Rescue Mission. It's the New York Rescue Mission now there in New York. And old Jim, he wanted me to come up and preach, but I don't know if he was struggling with money or whatever, but he didn't want to give me an offering. And I said, "Jim," I said, "I don't need an offering. Just let me come up here. I'll pay my own way. I'll sleep in your office. I'll eat soup with the bums." And I did. I went up there, and I'm telling you, I slept on his couch in his office. I ate soup with the bums. I preached every night. And I'm telling you, me and them old street boys in New York had the best time you ever seen. But what old Jim did, instead of getting me an offering from his own hip pocket, he got me a meeting on 79th and Broadway at the First Baptist Church in downtown Manhattan. Me. Can you imagine, country boy? And I got up, and I'm telling you, there's 1,500 people down. They got a huge balcony. And I got up there that morning, and when they called me up, and they got this huge platform. And I got up there, and they got a little skinny pulpit stand. It looked like a music stand. And I'm looking at that stand, and I'm saying, "I'm going to hurt this thing. You don't know how clumsy I am. I break stuff like that easy." And so I put my Bible and my notes on it, and I'm watching how wobbly it is, and I'm trying to preach and keep the stand from falling. And then finally I said, "Oh, heck." And I said, and I just took me two Prozacs, and I just had me a Texas fit. I started preaching, kicking my boots up in the air. I left my notes and just started preaching. I started having myself a time. When I got through, there were six people that come down to that altar and knelt down at that invitation, six adults. I was standing at the back door when the church was over, and these people were filing out, shaking my hand. And here come this lady that had an animal wrapped around her neck. And it had glassy eyes, and its fang, its teeth were showing. It was Harriet, I swear the thing was alive. And she's coming up at me like this, and I'm saying, "My God, it's going to bite me." And when she got up there, she leaned up and she said, "They haven't given an invitation in here in 20 years. They started teaching all that Calvinism a long time ago." That's that old spirit of patriotism. That old gal, she loved it when she heard it. And that old spirit of patriotism, it loves preaching. It just loves preaching. Old Billy Sunday said, he said this. He said, he preached a message all over the United States called "Hot Cakes on the Griddle." And in that sermon, he said this. He said, "I've been through the blood, and I've been through the fire for Jesus. And if you preachers would stop preaching on the New Jerusalem and start preaching on whiskey and women in red light districts, you'd see God do something." That's that old spirit of patriotism that used to be. I was in London one time, and I went to the foundry, which was at the First Methodist Church that John Wesley built. And in that church, they had his original pulpit that you walk and you got to go around the stairs to get up to the top of it. And I'm sitting there looking at that beautiful carved wooden pulpit, and I asked the curator, I said, can I touch it? And he looked at me and he said, sir, we are not in the habit of touching things over here. He thought I was a nut. Mental patients, if you ever work with mental patients, they always want to touch things. And he looked at me like, I've got another one. This is a live one right here. But I just wanted to run my hand down that railing of that pulpit to just see if I could get something that old Wesley had. You see, I don't want that fire to die in the heart. I don't want to lose that flame. I don't want to lose that desire. I want it hot in my heart. But a spirit of patriotism for the church, it's not only for the preaching, but it's for them old songs. Them old songs that we used to sing. And one of my favorite songs is Onward Christian Soldiers. But my favorite lines in all that song is when it gets down and it says, Hell's foundation quivers. That's the whole song for me. You could throw out everything else and just say, Hell's foundation. And every time I hear it, my heart thrills. But do you know Hell's foundation quivers? Every time a sinner gets saved, Hell's foundation quivers. Did you know every time a sermon is preached, Hell's foundation quivers? Do you know every time somebody shouts, Hell's foundation quivers? Do you know every time the saints pray, Hell's foundation quivers? And I just wonder how much Hell's foundation quivers today. Arise, my soul, arise. Isn't that a great song? But you know what my favorite words are? Shake it off. I like that part. Shake off thy guilty. And then old Luther. Luther was a lover of music. You ever read old Luther's life? And Luther always said that music was a delightful gift from God. And when you read Luther, he was always given to depressions because he was fighting the Catholic Church so hard. And they said you could always tell when Luther was deep depressed because he would walk into that schoolroom and those old German boys there in Wittenberg that he was teaching that Bible and teaching them how to preach. They said he would walk in and he would say, boys, turn to Psalm 46 and let's sing. Them old boys and that old German bro would get to singing, and I can just hear them when they got down to that part and said, God is our refuge and we will not fear. That's what them old songs will do for you. Spirit of patriotism for preaching. A spirit of patriotism for singing. Patriotism for praying. People don't pray like they used to pray. Oh, they told Daniel, they said, look, there'll be no praying. They said they passed that law and said no praying for 30 days, and if you want anything, you got to ask the government. Old Daniel walked up there and threw them windows open on that courtyard and looked out, and he said, Our Father! Remember when Zacharias walked into the temple over there in the book of Acts? He walked in there. You talk about a patriarch for prayer. Zechariah walked in there, and when he started towards that to light the incense, Gabriel met him. And Gabriel looked at old Zechariah, and the first thing that he said to him was, Thy prayers have been heard. Do you know what prayers he was praying? Elizabeth was past childbearing. And Zechariah was an old man. But you know what they were praying for? A child. When it looked impossible and it looked improbable, that's that old spirit. Oh, they kept praying even when it looked like it was impossible. That's that old spirit of patriotism that used to be in people's lives when they prayed. Spirit of patriotism for the old Bible. Luther, when he was fighting that Catholic Church and there at the Diet of Worms, they called him down there. They were going to make him give an account of the things he was preaching and writing. And when he walked in the back door, and there's a lot of pictures in the books, he walks in that back door of that big church, and he's got an armload of books. And when he walks up there, there's 12 cardinals sitting at this big old table, long table, and he walks up there, and he drops them books on the table. And they ask him this question. They said, two questions. Are those books yours? He said, yes, they are. And he said, will you recant of everything you've written in those books? And he said, if the word is to be considered. Unless I have proof of Scripture, I neither can nor will recant. Here I stand, I can do no otherwise. And those words are immortal in the history books. Here I stand, I can do nothing else. That's that old spirit of patriotism that people used to have for the Bible. They're doing everything they can to get rid of any appearance of the Bible in the public. But my wife and I was in Philly not too long ago, and we went down to look, and we went down to the Independence Hall, and we went to see the Liberty Bell. And do you know what we found stenciled on the Liberty Bell? Leviticus 25:10. And it says, proclaim liberty throughout all the land. So if they are true to their cause, they're going to have to throw the Liberty Bell out too. But I'm telling you, they're going to have a hard time doing that. When Texas was fighting for its independence, we was in the museum in downtown Austin not too long ago. And there's a story that Santa Ana had given them Texans a little cannon. And when the war started, he wanted that cannon back. But I can tell you right now, if you ever give Texas something, you're not getting it back. No, we ain't letting you have it back. And he sent some dignitaries up there to Gonzales, Texas to get that cannon. They said, no, you can't have it. So they went back. So here comes Santa Ana with a whole troop. I mean, he's got 1,000 troop up there to kill a handful of Texans over a cannon. And I read in a book the other day that it was the women. They got a flag up there in that museum. But the women took a big white sheet and made a flag, and they wrote these words on it: come and get it. And I mean, here's a handful of Texans fixing to fight thousands of Mexicans, and they got this flag saying, come and get it. Can I tell you that one of these days they may be after your book? But you're going to have to get a grip on it, and with the same spirit they had, you're going to say, if you want it, you're going to have to come and get it. That's that old spirit of patriotism that you better have, that is slowly dying in our churches and in our country. Not only a patriotism for the church, but a patriotism for Christ. A love that is so strong and so willing to live and serve Him and die for Him. And don't tell me it hasn't been done. History is full of books of people that gave their life for the love of Christ. The Apostle Paul said this. He said, for me, I can't speak for you. But he said, for me to live is Christ. And to die is gain. Can I tell you, that's an old spirit of patriotism that used to be in people's lives. Paul said the love of Christ constrains us. The love of Christ compels us to do things that people will never understand. The love of Christ compels us to do things that nobody looking at us can understand what we're doing. But you see, the Apostle Paul, he knew where the power came from. The Apostle Paul knew where all the preach came from. The Apostle Paul knew where all the prayer and the push came from. And Paul knew that it was not so much his love for Christ as it was Christ's love for him. Because you see, our love for the church, it's really not our love. Because we didn't love the church until he came in. And when he came in, we loved the church. So that's his love in us. We didn't love the Bible until he came in. And when he came in, we fell in love with this old book. So it's not our love, it's his love in us. It's not our love for a lost world. We didn't care nothing about the sinners until he came in. Then when he came in, we begin to worry and concern and pray for the lost. But that's his love in us. And if that love has lost its flame for the church, or the Bible, or the sinner, if you don't love it with the passion that you once did or that you ought to have? John writes that we left our first love. He didn't say we lost it. Because if you lose something, you can't find it. There's a possibility you can't find it. But he said we left our first love, which means that you left it. If you had it, you left it somewhere, and you can go back and pick it up again. Because you see, when he was here among us, he said, upon this rock, I'm going to build my church. And that love came into us when he came. When he was here among us, he said, the word of God's forever settled in heaven and earth. Not one jot, one tittle will pass away. And that is in him when he comes in us. That was his love. He said, I come to seek and to save that which was lost. That's his love that comes. I was in Baltimore some time back. And I love reading about the Civil War. And in reading about the Civil War, if you ever read about the Battle of Antietam there at Sharpsburg, south of Baltimore, and always, they call it the bloodiest day of the Civil War. There were 35,000 boys from the Union and the South died in Miller's Cornfield at the Battle of Antietam. And I have looked at the pictures of them trenches with them twisted bodies and bloated bodies of all them boys. And in all the pictures of Miller's Cornfield, it always shows a white stone church right beside the cornfield. And they called it Dunker's Church. And I always sat and looked at the bodies that were laying around that church. And it shows the cannons with the wheels shot out from under it, leaning up against, in the courtyard of that old church. And I used to say, you know, I'd love to go to Antietam. Because I want to see Dunker's Church. And so I got them to take me down to the Battle of Antietam. And there at Miller's Cornfield, they got all these massive monuments dedicated to the troops of Wisconsin, the troops of Georgia, the troops of Maryland, the troops of Louisiana. There's all these monuments, and how many men from each state were that died in that battle. And there stood Dunker's Church. It was still there. 150 years almost now. That church is still there. And I went over and drug my hands around that church. And you can still feel the imprints of the mini balls in that church. And right across the street, Matt, would you come to the piano? Right across the street, there's a museum. And when you walk in the front door of that museum, encased in glass was a King James Bible that was on the pulpit the day of that battle back in 1863, 1864. And I sat there and I looked at that Bible encased in glass, and I looked back across the street, and there stood Dunker's Church. And I went back across the street, and I stood on the front steps of that white stone church. And I looked out across Miller's Cornfield at all the monuments. And I said, you know, battle's over. No more dying. No more bleeding. No more pain. No more agony. No more suffering. It's all over. And you know what two things remained after 140-something years? The Bible and the church are still there. And one of these days, life is going to be over for us. And there'll be no more pain, no suffering, no dying, no agony, no heartache. And when life's over, you know what two things are going to exist? The Bible and the church. And the smartest thing that you and I would ever do tonight is get our life in the church and our hand on that Bible and ride the storms of life and get that old spirit of patriotism that loves the church, loves the Bible to the point that we're willing to die for it. Would you bow your heads with me? I wonder if you'd come tonight. Just say, Lord, I confess to you. I just don't love the church like I used to or like I need to. I just don't love my Bible like I ought to, or like I need to. But I want you tonight to build a fire inside my heart. Put a flame that all the troubles of life can't put out. That I can love you and love the church and love the Bible with all my heart until my dying day.